Hello, how you doing? I'm Craig Parkinson. You are listening to the Two Shot Podcast. Sit yourself down, pop the kettle on. We're going to have a nice old chat. Who's it with this week? I'm going to tell you right now. How the devil are you? Oh, it's Thursday, but I'm not here. Well, I'm here, but I'm not. I'm on holiday, as you know. But I thought we should definitely have an episode, considering we missed last week. Again, apologies. Just, you know, life. This week I'm joined by Tim Downey, and it does get quite actory, and I don't mean that in a disrespectful way. We do talk about the trajectory of a career and how things don't happen straight away. You know, I'm sure we all know that, but I think it's really important for younger actors to hear Tim's journey, and he's just an absolute delight. Look, you're going to know Tim from the mega smash Outlander. Is that how you say it? Outlander? Did I say Outlander? No, that's not what we emphasise. Outlander. And, Upstart Crow, which is a huge smash for new comedy. And, of course, the excellent Toast of London, which obviously stars past DSP favourite, the delicious Matt Berry. And if you haven't listened to that episode, do go back. In fact, go back and listen to everything before this. No, I mean, you don't have to. You choose at your leisure. But Tim is a joy, and do follow him on Instagram, because we start off talking about how during lockdown one, he started reading children's stories, and they grew and grew and grew and became quite the smash. He is a lovely, lovely chap, and I think you're going to enjoy this very, very much. This is the Two Shot Podcast with the wonderful Tim Downey. Enjoy. I'll see you at the end. Tim Downey, how are you?
Very good, mate. How are you?
I'm good. I feel that certainly when I was watching you quite a lot, I got quite addicted to you reading stories over Instagram during lockdown. But I do feel that any time I see you, your moustache has become somewhat of a trademark. And then when I don't see you with it on telly, it reminds me of a time when, because my dad's always had a moustache, and when my sister was young, for the first time I can remember, he shaved it off and she would not go near him, and she just burst into tears.
That is exactly the same thing that happened to my youngest. My eldest couldn't really care one way or the other, just sort of like, oh, it's daddy, that's fine. But I shaved it off for the first time, I think, in her life, at least where she was aware that I was actually taking it off, when I was doing Outlander. And I had planned this whole elaborate kind of setup of going, well, I'll do it with her and sit her down and you can see the whole thing. As I had heard, that is what you should do. Obviously, run out of time, took it off. She went off to school, came back, opened the door, went, hello. And again, burst into tears, didn't it? And still mentions it to this day, like a year and a half from the first time that I did it. Don't do that again, Daddy. Don't shave that off.
Already that's years of therapy, and that's on you. You'll be absolutely shelling it out later.
Oh, yeah. No, oh, yeah. Paying it forward with that.
No, I remember when I had a beard for about 18 months, but like a big old huge thing covering my face, and I just got the clippers out and got my little boy to come to the bathroom and just go, right, you take it all off. And he was how old was he? Probably about 5 or 6.
I think that's the age, isn't it? It's about around that age, that pivotal age. 5. My youngest, 5. Same thing.
Tim, what was the idea? Where did the idea come for reading these stories that you were doing on Instagram? Because it seems to me that that is a CBB show that doesn't seem to be happening.
Well, I agree. I think they're missing an absolute trick there. I think it was a mixture of a lot of different things. It was a mixture of trying to entertain children in lockdown, as in mine, and trying to keep them interested, because I think I started it during lockdown one, and there was that kind of peak of lockdown one, which was you can only go out for an hour a day. You can only, there was so little you could do. So it was a mixture of, okay, well, I, you know, we could tell stories. That's, again, it kind of fed into what was being taken away from being storytellers and actors and creatives, is you couldn't really do that. So I thought, well, I could try and combine two things together, is try and entertain children and stop them climbing the walls and destroying my house, and telling some stories and just doing a little something. And then it kind of just evolved from that. A few people mentioned it on Instagram, and my wife said, that's quite a good idea, why don't you do that? And I was like, I don't know, is anyone even going to watch it? I mean, who's going to watch that? Then we thought, okay, well, we'll do it a little bit. And I only planned, like, okay, I'll do it for like 5 evenings, and that's it. And then it ended up being the entirety of that first lockdown, doing it every single night, which was quite something. But it became incredibly therapeutic after a while as well.
Well, having, I was going to say,
having a little break,
you know? And a routine, having a little routine as well.
Absolutely.
When everything else is just in disarray.
Yeah, yeah. And it was just kind of time out of time, like with all the kind of horrors and people kind of running around, go, oh God, what are we going to do? You know, for like sort of 10, 15 minutes, you could just sort of say, well, this is harking back to childhood. This is nothing better than when someone just says, I'll read you a story. Let me tell you a story. And when it's a good story, I don't think there's anything better than telling a story and having that moment of just innocence, of just kind of, this is your break. And I had friends, or rather, you know, people in all over the world that were sort of saying, you know, I'm an ambulance driver in New York, and I would take my break for that 10, 15 minutes, or make sure my break was around that time. And it was just a break from everything, just for a minute, just for that little gap of just being simply read a story and being silly, and it being almost like as it was before these end times.
Mm.
It was, that, you know, back to as it was before.
But also to take you away. And I remember, and I've said this before on the podcast, and not to get bogged down in all the lockdown talk, because I don't really like that. We need to get away from that. But I did find it hard to focus, and I love to read so much. So for somebody to sit down and just read you a story when your focus is completely out the window is such a lovely, warm, cuddly thing to do. Because, you know, I mean, we got quite addicted to Taika Waititi as well when he was reading, what was he? I want to say James and the Giant Peach, and I might be wrong. Mm. But anyway, whichever one. And he got a whole host of different people sort of every week to come in. And it was just a lovely, warm, delicious thing to just look forward to every night.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was great. The only downside is suddenly you go from sort of having 4 or 5 kids' books to sort of saying, I've got over like 200 books now that then people sort of like send in and go, oh, this was my favourite when I was a kid. Please read this. And they'd, you know, send it to your agents. And suddenly you just kind of go, I have hundreds and hundreds of kids' books now. Which was, you know, which was great. And some, you know, you do begin to discern what's a good book, what isn't good, what really works, and what sort of fits in with, you know, what I like and what, you know, my kids like. Anything with voices, my kids loved. And if you have silly voices, you have as many different characters as possible talking to each other. I guess it's because it sounds visual in that strange way.
Mm.
You kind of go, oh, okay, this is what this looks like or that looks like. And
but yeah, as well, so, you as Tim reading also became a slightly heightened character, a slightly heightened version of you. It was like you were, oh, hello, you're welcoming these people. And it really reminded me of, and younger listeners won't know what we're talking about, but when Jack and Nori was at its peak.
Yeah.
And I used to get so excited, and I remember my favourite because it was Rick Mail reading George's Marvelous Medicine.
My absolute favourite.
Because it was almost like he'd gatecrashed Jack and Ori, and he wasn't really allowed to be there because he's so Rick and that heightened Rick, and it was so anarchic, and it was almost naughty when you shouldn't be watching it, but it was brilliant. I have such strong memories of that. I think we need to bring that back for people. It's such...
Absolutely, absolutely. It's definitely that anarchic left field. I mean, I even felt the same when Kenneth Williams was reading Will-O' the Wisp.
Yeah.
And there was a certain edginess to her, you know, with Evil Edna and the characters in that. I think that obviously is what kids of our generation, that slightly folk horror-y, slightly edgy way of telling kids' stories with a bit, you know, you're not softening anything up, you're giving it edges, which kids love and adore. Anything with an edge.
They love a bit of naughtiness. I think that's why Horrible Histories has worked as well as it has for children, because, of course, my little boy absolutely adores it, because some of it is a bit edgy, and it's just on that level of, cheekiness and naughtiness, but they're learning at the same time. So I love all that. I think it's fantastic. There's nothing worse than... You know, like when you're talking to a child, there's nothing worse than pandering down to a child.
Absolutely.
If you speak to them on a level as just a small human being, I think they respond so much better.
Absolutely, and they get it. They do understand. They like to be told. Like, my kids like just to know what's going on, rather than living in a world of just do it. And they don't like that. They don't like that uncertainty. I mean, we're always told, early parents, kids like routine and kids like a certain way of doing things because they like to kind of know what's happening. I don't think that changes. I think you've got to kind of keep them up to speed, like going, right, now we're going to do this and this is why we're doing it, or now this is why this has changed and this is why this has happened. And they're very willing to go, okay, fine, I get that, we'll move on, that's fine.
So I suppose it's about honesty.
Yeah.
I don't know, I think we're all constantly learning as parents.
Failing.
Oh, and learning.
Every day, many times a day, many times before breakfast, to be honest.
I remember saying during homeschooling time, right, if I don't lose my shit till lunchtime, I'll be happy with myself. That will be a success. Yeah. Definitely by 11. But we just not look out the window. We have to do this.
It was just endless. I can remember looking at the timetable and going, oh, God, almost feeling like I was 7 again. I go, what's up first? Oh, fucking hell, it's maths. Oh, God, got an hour of that. God. And I would just spend most of my time saying, okay, just sit down and do the maths. Sit down a bit, do the maths. And then you'd wander off to try and send an email. Come back and the room would be empty. Now, where have you gone? What are you doing? You do not need the loo again. Did you do it? Have you done it? Yes, I've done it. Well, let's have a look. You've done one question, and that's wrong. So you've done nothing. You've done nothing. I'm just going to have to sit. Please don't let me chain you to the fucking dead. Just please. Please, just do these number bonds or whatever the fuck this is. I don't even know what it is anymore.
We're not teachers. I remember, and apologies to the listeners if I've repeated myself on this, but I remember listening to Sophie Alice Baxter was on Radio 4 on a Saturday morning, and she was talking about this, and she was saying, yeah, but we're not teachers. They are trained, they're highly skilled professionals at what they do. So we call it emergency education. And I thought she was so on the money with that, because we're rushing to the rescue to try and patch things up with plasters and pencil sharpeners and rubbers. But it's emergency education. Call in the parents. They're not great, but they'll give it a go.
Yeah.
Going back to the moustache, and not that this podcast is all about the moustache.
No.
How did it come about? Because sometimes, we mess about with facial hair on jobs. Was it something that you had to grow? You grew it and it just stuck?
Yeah, exactly. I grew it for a film many moons ago. I can't even remember how, about 8 years or something like that, maybe more. And then for one reason or other, I think it was funding, the film fell through. So I was left. It was actually like a musketeer film. So I actually had a big moustache and a little kind of sort of musketeery chin piece as well. And I thought, do I shave it or do I keep it? And then I thought, well, hang on, this'll fox other actors. Because if, as an actor, if you walk around with distinct facial hair, it unnerves other actors. They go, well, obviously he's obviously working because you would not choose that as a thing to just walk around and go to Sainsbury's in. that's obviously a thing. And you just wouldn't comment on it like other actors. No, no, this? Yes, I'm just carrying this around, of course. And then it just stuck. And then I got cast in something else. I thought, okay, with the moustache. Okay, well, I'll keep it. And if someone wants me to take it off, I'll take it off. And then it just kind of stuck. It had many sort of different moulds and shapes and all different types of things over the years. And now it's just become sort of part and parcel of my face, so much so that my children scream at me if I take it off. But it's just kind of there now, and I can't really remember a time. When I do take it off, I actually, for a first, I would say 3 days, look like a turtle, because obviously the weight of that hair on the top lip pulls the top lip down. So it kind of talks very much sort of like with an underbite. And so that's disconcerting, because you do have those echoes of yourself before moustache. We go, I was good looking once. I'm pretty sure of that. And you look at the mirror and go, God, I really, what the hell happened there? The years have not been kind. And then three or four days later, it plumps back up. Natural collagen plumps it up. You go, okay, fine. It's vaguely good. Age has ravaged me, but it's vaguely good.
Now, sometimes with the information I get on the internet, it is incorrect. So we're going to throw this out. Are you a 1977 baby?
I am indeed.
Right. So by my reckoning, with you being the year above me at drama school.
Yeah.
So you started, because I thought I started young at 17, just on the cusp of, well, just about 18. Yeah. So you were 17 when you started. Is that right?
Yeah, so I think I was actually 16, because actually it's my birthday in 2 weeks. So I'm a young, for the year, I'm a young baby, as it were. But I auditioned for Mount View when I was 15, which was
it's ridiculous. I've never heard of it.
It's ridiculous. And I think in my head, I thought to myself, well, if I lie about it, people will believe it. Now, I saw a photo the other day of me at that sort of 15, 16. And in my head, I look very similar to as I look now, you know, like a man. And I looked at it and I look about 11, if anything at all. That sort of classic 90s curtains, baby faces, you like. You've got to think, I mean, I'm not that good an actor. There's no way I could have upped my own age in that way. But somehow it happened. So yeah, so when I actually started, I was 16 going on 17, which was quite something. 94, I think it was. I think I started in 1994, or the January, that was the next intake.
Do you ever look back and think, yeah, that was too young?
Very much. Yeah, very, very much. Because you need the experience. And I remember, you know, lots of drama teachers beforehand saying, you know, it's all about experience. And as a young actor, you kind of think, I don't need experience. I'll play it. It's fine. I'll find it. But you do. You really do need experience. You really do need all of that to give you the nuance and to give you those little edges and little stories within stories that you need to tell as an actor when you're doing a part. All the layers, like an onion, all kind of come together. And but yeah, bloody hell, I was far too young. I remember on one of the very first days, we were doing one of those round circle things, and they were sort of going round, where's everyone from? You know, this is Dave from Ipswich, and this is, you know, whoever. How old are you? 32. Oh, right, shit. How old are you? You know, I'm, you know, Lucy, I'm 24 and everything. And then it kind of comes to you. So I think that was an eight. Yeah, I'm 18. No one seems to be throwing. Yeah, we're all on the same page there. We're all just gonna just leave that where it is. Fine. Then I'm 18, and we'll just leave that there. I think that'll be easier.
Because I remember somebody in my who was, I think, 27, and I remember thinking at the time, oh, crikey, that's old.
That is old. That's old. Goodness me.
But now, I mean, I remember saying to younger actors, you know, you don't You don't need... I know you feel that you want to get there and you want to get to drama school and you want to train, you want to get out there and start working straight away, but there's plenty of time.
Yeah.
There's plenty of time.
You think it's all going to be over by the end of the year. You think, if I don't get it done right now, that's it. It's done, it's over. If I don't make it, or how I perceive making it to be, by like the age of 24, it's done. It's done. And you might as well not bother. But it's just, just absolutely isn't true in any way. It needs time. It's like a fine, a fine wine or a fine meal. It needs time, and time is wonderful for that. It just enriches things and your experience and your approach and all sorts of things. But, 16 was too young.
Is that what you felt? Is that why you were... Because I know why I was... just rushing to leave Blackpool to get to London as quickly as possible. But is that what you were doing? Because where was it? You were Hertfordshire?
Hertfordshire, yeah. So I grew up in a little village called Shillington in Hertfordshire. And I think I was. I never really felt sort of at home in the place I was, that was my home. You know, I was always...
In what way, Tim?
Well, in a way that, it was... growing up in the middle of nowhere... And you either kind of are a country person or you're not, or you enjoy that, or you... And I just was bored. And my likes were never the likes of any of my contemporaries. I liked reading, and I liked reading weird shit, and I liked poetry, and I liked, sort of just... I deliberately sought out the odd things, the oddness of things, and the alternative or the left field, just because I was just fascinated by it, rather than just what I was kind of prescribed or just given by what was out there at the time. And and that kind of ostracizes you a little bit, because you kind of are seen as weird or odd that you would like. If you're going to have a movie night, I would say, well, let's watch some Cronenberg. You're like, you want to watch David Cronenberg? You want to watch Rabid or Shivers? yeah, let's watch that. You don't want to watch... Back to the Future. Well, yeah, I've seen it, but why don't we watch this piece of, Canadian horror? You're odd. Very strange. So, I don't know. Things like that. So,
Do you think in some respects, and this concerns going to drama school, and I suppose, who you've grown up to be now, that you were kind of old before your time?
I think so. I think I've kind of...
Do you know what I mean by that? And absolutely. I do mean that as a compliment.
No, very much. No, I think it's been mentioned that I've kind of grown into my face. That kind of... Or just the idea of certain things. I don't know if I was ever that young, but was in a certain extent. It's difficult to explain. It's always, quite carefree and things, but I liked things that weren't kind of the age, or like, if I liked... I can remember showing, or wanting to show my sister once, Hellraiser, when she was 8.
Right.
And...
Responsible.
Very responsible, sort of elder brother sort of behaviour. And, but I was... What I wanted to sort of say to her is, well, let's watch the making of first. Let's watch the making of, and we can kind of work out how these things are done and the mechanics behind it, because it's a story. It's not real. It's a story. And it's just the way they tell the story that makes the difference. I mean, it still scared the living shit out of her, and I still think she talks about it now. And I, fish hooks, not really the thing for her. Don't want to do that.
It's a terrifying film.
Oh, it's dreadful. It's dreadful. But she was fascinated with the special effects of the melting body and how they did it by setting up heaters and just kind of melting this figure into the floor and then reversing the film and coming back out again. But I found that, endlessly fascinating, the creativity of it, and just, that's how you do it. Maybe I can use something like that. And just wanted to kind of take as much as possible, be it comedy or some weird, Swedish film from the 40s or something like that. I want all of it. Give me all of it. I want as much as can be done. And when you're growing up in a tiny village, it's not that easily accessible. As we probably experienced as well. There are certain parts it's very difficult, especially when there was no internet. You had to kind of physically hunt these things out or find a conduit somewhere that would kind of be your gateway into kind of, this is a route to take. This is world cinema. This isn't, but this is. These are some great authors. You should read these. Try this. And that was very, very good, really good.
So there was a thirst for that sort of, slightly arty left field knowledge.
Yeah, yeah. But these are the films I almost kind of grew up on, of like, you know, Beat Takashi's early work and you know, Bergman I adore and watched and watched and watched. And I think that was probably influenced as well from either reading like Bukowski, because Bukowski mentions there's a Norwegian writer called, I think it's called Knut Hamsun, who he read a lot of. He wrote The Hunger. See what I mean? Look, already you're going,
right,
oh,
right. So you go, right, Bukowski says that.
Then I move on to this one because he was Norwegian then, and he was very influenced by the early films of, you know, the cinematography of Nyquist and Bergman. So I'll have a look at that. I'll see what that's all about. What's so special about this? And then suddenly that opens up this huge world of things. And you're going, wow, that's extraordinary. And then you're watching Bill and Ted and realize that that's been borrowed from The Seventh Seal, of playing chess and on the beach, and they're playing battleships, and you realize that all these things are interlinked
and influenced,
massively influenced. You go, oh my God, this is amazing. This is extraordinary. What else is like that? And then, you know, out it goes.
Did you find coming to London that the doors were more or less sort of flung open to you in that respect for gaining more knowledge in that arena?
Absolutely. And that's what I always wanted. I just wanted that space to, you know, explore things and, yeah, find what you like and what you don't like, and, you know, where I grew up, it just wasn't there. So London was the place for that, a big city. I think I've always been a city dweller, even though I've lived in a village. You know, I've always wanted that sort of noise, and if I want to go out at, you know, 10 o'clock at night, I can find a coffee, or if I want to, you know, nothing all shuts at 4 and that kind of thing. So yeah, so that, I think that was a main drive to get out of the village and things like that.
How were your parents with this? Because it, you know, we've already established that even now, as you know, early 40-year-old men, we both agree that was ridiculously young.
Mm.
So how were they? Were they supportive of this?
My father thought it was all very strange. My father still thinks it's very strange that I'm an actor. Like, he can't.
What did your father do for a living, Tim?
He was in the building trade, so he was a surveyor,
right,
for many years for a company called McCarthy and Stone, who do retirement homes and things like that. So his world was very, very different to the one that I was kind of entering. And he still finds it odd that I do. Great fan of comedy, which is where I've got my sort of love and adoration for comedy. That's all he would ever listen to, was like Hancock or Round the Horn or The Goons, and would watch Arthur Askey or Will Hay or Ealing comedies, Guinness and all of that. So that's where I kind of get my love of comedy, is from that education. But I don't think he ever wanted to watch anything made after about 1958. Like, anything after that was a bit risky. It was getting a little bit edgy, this. So me going in to do what I'm doing, he still finds it awkward. You know, if someone kisses on screen, even if it's just sort of goodbye, dear, mwah, he finds it very, oh, dear. Oh, that's unnecessary. So, you know. You obviously suggest Game of Thrones straight away, just to see what his reaction would be to that. But my mother, who had a much stricter upbringing, was very much for it. She had opportunities that were presented to her, but her parents says, "No, you're not doing it. You're doing what we're telling you to do," and that's
right.
And that's the beginning and the end of it. So I think because I showed signs of this sort of creativeness or this artiness, and the want and desire to do it, I think she was very much sort of like, well, you do it. Don't let any fucker tell you any different. You do it. And if you want to go now, then we'll do it. We'll make it happen. You go for it. And I will support you as much as is needed. Having known nothing, like, I'm not from a background of, you know, artists or people that knew people in London, you know. I knew nobody, nothing. The only kind of link to the arts was basically kind of local Amdrams and then drama school, and that was it. There wasn't anyone sort of like, oh, you know, such and such knows such and such.
Were you doing drama at school, or was that not an option?
Yeah, little bits and pieces. It was mainly through the Bancroft Players, which is oddly where Ben Whishaw went.
Right.
Because he was in school with me, but about 2 or 3 years younger. And so it had elements of artiness around the area, but it was never really kind of pushed. But the Bancroft Players was a bit of sort of a haven, and there were some really good people that went there, and some real artists, and they did nurture as far as they could people that wanted to do it. Like they took shows to Edinburgh and things like that, and just sort of showed them the way. But that was it. But then, go back to my mother is then deciding, okay, well, if you want to do it, then let's do it. I remember one time my school said I think it was about 15, or maybe a bit younger, maybe about 13, 14, and it was work experience. And they said, what do you want to do? And I said, I want to be an actor. They went, no, seriously. What would you like to do? I want to be an actor. Okay, well, there's an opening in the local museum who are doing a piece about the Second World War, and they need someone to dig a trench. But I want to be an actor. It's very arty, though. It's for a performance piece about. So they need you to dig a trench. Okay, I don't know about that. So my mother said, "That's ridiculous." I will write to Kenneth Branagh. Okay, I'll find his address or wherever somewhere. They're doing something somewhere. And I think he was doing Hamlet at the Barbican. So I'll write to the Barbican. I'll write, Kenneth Branagh, care of the Barbican. So she wrote to him, didn't hear anything. And then about sort of 2 weeks later, a letter arrives from Kenneth Branagh saying, oh, I hear your son. Thank you for your letter, Mrs. Downey. We'd very much like to have your son for work experience. If he would like to join us on our run at the Barbican, we think that would be fantastic. Would love to arrange it. So I took that into school, kind of going, isn't this amazing? It's Kenneth Branagh.
This saying, is amazing.
I want to, he wants me to do work experience with him. And they went, that's great. You're digging trenches.
What?
Yeah. So I then had to go and dig a trench for 2 weeks, which gives you an idea of kind of, the artiness of, or the sort of.
Fucking hell. I'm gutted for you. I've got really unbelievably excited.
Gutted. So unbelievably gutted. Although I did. Wonderful thing is how things come around is when I did the Christmas edition of Upstart Crow, it had Kenneth Branagh, and I told him that story. And he was very upset. I didn't come and see him, but he thought it was a wonderful story. And, to sort of say thank you to my mum.
I was about to say, please tell me you've bumped into Kenneth Branagh or you've told him that story.
I have.
Tim, did you keep the letter?
I did. My mother still has it. Signed at the bottom. My mother still has it in sort of like, her little files of the things that I have done.
The work experience that could have been.
That could have been. The great. Who knows what would have happened. But, ended up in Letchworth digging a trench.
How awful for your school to completely lock the door on that and go, no, you're digging a trench.
Yeah, this is what's on offer. Let's not start getting above ourselves. This is what you're doing.
Well, that's it, isn't it? No. Know your place.
Absolutely.
I'm sure you do want to try and pursue a career in the arts, and I'm sure you can do that in your own spare time.
Yeah.
But let's be serious about this. Yeah. The amount of times that I've heard careers advisors who used to say things like that. Yes. Well, wouldn't that be nice?
Yes.
But that doesn't happen to people like you.
Yeah, exactly. Look around. It's not going to happen. So this is lovely. Thank you for the conversation. You wasted 5 minutes of my life. So now let's think about something. It's about a trade.
It's so incredible. Certainly in the past 20 years, I would say, when, street casting has become ever so popular, and they've been, when Des Hamilton was going around trying to cast This Is England and looking for Tomo's character, and they just went, right, okay, let's go to Grimsby and let's try and find somebody, let's go around schools and pluck somebody out, and I always say to the younger actors as well, I know you're excited and I know you feel you want to go to drama school, but that isn't always the route, and it doesn't have to be.
No.
Because for all those people that are being told, yes, stay in your box. It doesn't happen to people like you. The thing is, it could happen. So you have to be open-minded if you want to pursue that as a career.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you've got to be driven, and you've got to really want it as well. And there is so much talent out there, and I worry that what will happen. Like, yeah, the other thing as well is we didn't have any money. Like, we were not a wealthy family. We were sort of, you know, we had books and music and things like that, which is, and that's kind of it. Like, we didn't have expendable cash. So the idea of spending, I think at the time it was something like $2,000 or $3,000 a term for Mount View. There's just no way. There's just no way. So I actually got a grant, which was the last year that the council gave grants. And then after that, they cut all arts funding.
Mm.
And my worry is that you will make the arts too elitist. Is that it's only sustainable for families with money, which then narrows that pool and becomes far too monoculture. And the beauty of this country is the richness of its diversity and the stories from all corners of it. And they're the ones I want to hear. I want to hear all those stories, and I want those different accents and voices. I want all of this. I worry that it'll just narrow and narrow and narrow.
But it is a worry. It's a huge worry, because then all we're churning out is the same voices, the same stories, and we won't be getting the stories from every angle and every region. You know, I mean, I was talking to somebody about how I wished that the lovely play for today's was still going on, and I want to see that one-off that's set in Nottingham, or I want to know about that couple in Glasgow who are deeply unhappy. And we need to keep churning those stories out, you know. And I think it's, you know, it is people like Jimmy McGovern and like Shane Meadows who are driving that on and plucking people out of obscurity and going, look at that talent. Look at what we've just found there. We don't have to keep casting the same people that the BBC are pushing on us, because there are voices out there and they need to be heard, and those stories do need to be told, because people need to see and hear them.
Absolutely do, because you need that little kid that's, you know, sitting in Grimsby or something like that to be inspired and to think, yes, that could be me. That
exactly.
could be me, because I've seen, because it's I am there, I'm reflected back.
And the thing is, even when we get into these discussions, and I've done many times, there is room for everybody. It's
Absolutely.
Not, well, I would never dream of quote-unquote posh bashing. It's not about that.
No.
It's like, I want, as you just said, you know, I want that person who is sat there watching or listening to something going, oh, look, there's a person who sounds like me, who has the same skin colour as me, who looks a little bit odd, that's a bit like me. Yeah. That, therefore, that could be me. I could do it. It could be a viable option. Mm. That's the thing when I do these podcasts and we get very passionate. Obviously, you can't, no one can see me. I'm just like getting my hands and putting my hands around someone's neck and throttling them. So speaking of training, we've established that you were young, and I don't think you regret it, but would you have, if we could go back and change, would you have paused and taken on some more life experience before you dived into those 3 years? Or do you think, well, that was the time and I did it and we shouldn't really look back?
I think it's a little from column A and a little from column B. Because I think, you know, I wanted to get out of where I was, and I wanted just to do what I wanted to do. I just wanted to do that. That's what I wanted to do. So let's just go and do that. It's almost like what we've been saying before is, well, why not? Go and try it. Just try it. See. Go and try. Nothing worse in this life than kind of looking back and thinking, if only. If only I'd have done this, I wonder what, if only. So there's part of me that thinks, no, good, I'm glad I did it. It was, you know, reckless to do it. But how exciting is that? That's kind of the spice of life, is being taking it by the scruff of the neck and just running
with
it.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Just to see what will happen, you know, running with the bulls for a second. But there's another aspect that thinks I probably would have got more out of it if I had been a little bit older, if I had been 18, 19, 20, within that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And just because the growth that I had within those years between 16 to 19 was absolutely monumental. Like, it just the explosion. You kind of, you know, it's you almost learn as much within those 3 years as you have done in the last 16, 17, because it is so eye-opening. So there is an element of that. If I could have had that experience but kind of shoved it into a 16-year-old, then it would have been perfect.
I think you're right, you know, and, you know, we can carry on for years saying, if only, mm. and it's not the healthiest of questions to keep asking yourself. And also, the level of intensity over that 3 years, it can be overwhelming at times.
Yeah, totally. And you know, many times it was. Many times I felt like I was treading water, just like going, I have no idea what is going on, or emotions that you are feeling and that kind of thing, because they're kind of bringing it out, or all sorts of things, relationships with people, the complexities of relationships with older people and people from different areas, and all these kind of things that you just had not experienced because you grew up in the village and you went to the local school in the town that was the next one along. So your world was tiny. It was, you know, my world was surrounded by the Chilterns, and that's basically it. So it was extraordinary. And it was quite interesting. I did My Teenage Diary with Rufus Hound a couple of months ago. And they said, go through the diary. So I found my diary from 1994, my first year at Mount View. And what I hadn't realised is I have so many sort of certain memories that I thought were kind of scattered over like a celestial 3 years, 4 years. And it all happened in that first year. All of these things were concertinaed into like a kind of 6 month time span, which was like, bloody hell, a lot happened. There was a lot of flim flam. There was a lot of sort of like, do they like me? Do they not? But there were certain other moments where you go, God, that's extraordinary. My first sort of big London gig was in 1994. My first sort of like, you know, heartbreaks were in 1994 that you write about, you know, really kind of milestones.
Yeah.
It's like, God, it all happened in 1994. What a year. Height of Britpop. I mean, who knew? Who knew it all happened?
And coming through that experience and then stepping out into what we hope is going to be the start of a career, as we know, for everybody, it's never that easy.
No.
And it's never as smooth as what you think.
Mm.
And I may be wrong here, because obviously we haven't spoken for years and years and years and years and years. But obviously I've seen what you've been doing, and it seems to me from the outside that things have been gently simmering over the years. And then certainly I feel over, say, the past 5 to 7 years, everything seems to have come to a head, and there's lots, you're scattering lots and lots of different things, certainly, and especially different comedy when you're comparing something like Upstart Crow, or then you're doing Toast of London, or then you're in this huge Outlander, which is like blown up all over the world.
Mm.
Do you think, and here's the thing, when I was at drama school in my final year, I was sat down, and they, you know, they give you some sort of overall encouragement and assessment, and I was told, "Well, you'll never work until you are in your 40s because you have this face and you're a character actor." And you know, they were wrong. So, but I feel that the older, or certainly the way that you've grown into yourself, has encouraged these parts to come at quite a pivotal point in your career.
Yeah, I think that's probably true, and I think it also comes with a sense. I think that almost like that turning point was the change between being sort of like a young actor that kind of fits into certain brackets, sort of like being a young upstart actor, because I was so young, so you're kind of put into certain points. And then there's that kind of sea change as you kind of shift from one gear into the other. And I think there's another aspect as well, is that because I think I was kind of brought up on a lot of comedy, and I think I kind of railed and against it by kind of thinking, well, I'm dark and brooding. I'm a dark brooding actor, and I'm very serious, and this is what I do. I'm, you know, dark and broody. And so you kind of fight against the instinct that's kind of in you, even though my instinct was going, well, you could make a gag out of that. If you did this or this, then that would make, you could do this or this, because it's kind of in your bones and your DNA to kind of twist it, look at it different ways. And then I think once I gave into that and kind of said, okay, that's fun, but that's fun. And I'm, dare I say, I'm quite good at that. So let's do that. And it kind of took the pressure off of trying to kind of mold yourself into something else. And just kind of go, well, I'm good at this, and let's see what that does. And I think in that kind of relaxing in my own head and creatively kind of relaxing, going, well, just because you're good at it doesn't mean it has to be difficult. That idea of if you're not struggling and really kind of beating yourself up and bleeding out of your eyes, then you're not doing your job, man. You have got to be really kind of up against it. You've got to be weeping every time you come home. But sometimes, you know, if you have a natural kind of propensity for something, then it's a joy. And I think allowing that joy in suddenly makes things a bit easier. It's like any relationship almost, you know. It shouldn't be difficult. It should, you go, oh, yeah, this is actually quite nice and almost quite relaxed in certain respects, because you're just allowing what you can do to come through. And then there's other brilliant people that will sort of channel wherever it is you're going to create the thing that you're doing. So that has been, yeah, a great revelation. And I think, allowing that to settle and kind of go, oh, this is who I am. This is who I am. I think that comes with age, is just being confident enough to go, okay, well, this is who I am, and this is what I can do. And then other people see that. It's like that old actor's thing about being, you'd never go into a casting and go, God, I need this. God, I need this. I need this so bad. If you don't cast me, I will not eat. My children will go shoeless. You know, you don't. People go, oh dear, no, that looks a little, oh, I can't spend 2 months with that. That's a bit, no. That's a well, bit much.
Exactly. You know, I mean, I want to talk about auditions a little bit, but it's a bit, you know, you go in, and I always say, certainly to younger actors, remember, you're going to be working with these people. So look at them. If they're dickheads, you're not going to be wanting to spend two or three. If they're directing you like that in the room, imagine what they're going to be like on the floor in front of a crew. They're going to be awful. And that's not going to be a nice experience for you, as much as you want to work and learn. So remember, I always think it's a two-way thing.
Very definitely. Very definitely.
Again, that takes experience and a bit more life and work knowledge to, I suppose, to be... well, knowledgeable, but also confident.
I was going to say, it's the confidence. It's that confidence.
Without being arrogant, obviously. Absolutely. I need to stress that.
Yeah, and it's the edge of knowing your worth and all that kind of thing. But it's also thinking, God, yeah, do I really want to work with these people for that amount of time? Because you're the worst thing in the world would be to get a job that you really, really want, and every job, you know, every actor really, really wants, and then to just spend 2 months of just hell, just going, God, this is awful, because it could really... tarnish, you know, years afterwards. No, just having that experience.
And I have to apologize to anybody listening if I'm repeating this story, but if you haven't heard this, I remember once being in an audition, and it is relevant to what we're talking about. So I was in an audition, and everything was running late. Nothing ever runs on time through no fault of anybody else most of the time. And I went in, and the director didn't seem very present in the room. And we started one of the scenes. And in the middle, his phone went off. And it rang and rang, and then he just switched it off. He didn't apologise. So I said, oh, can we just start again? Is that fine? Because that kind of threw me. Mm-hmm. Just start again. And it rang again. He didn't actually turn it off. He just... dismiss the call. Now, let's put the shoe on the other foot. If I was in there and my phone went off twice. Ooh. Now, do you not think, and this was some time ago, I'd say this was 10 to 12 years ago, I would be getting a call from an agent who was looking after me and I would be getting an absolute grilling on that point. So what I, you know, whether this was arrogant or not, I rang my agent and went, you can just pull me out. I would not want to work with him at all. If that's what he's like in an audition room.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got to remember, and sometimes he certainly didn't. Sometimes people don't. People work really hard to prepare and go in that room and they need to feel supported. And that is completely awful of him to do something like that. And, you know, especially over the past few months, we've heard about auditions where people have had to remove their clothes. You know, we'll talk about knowing your worth before. Go in there and, you know, with the best will in the world, try and own the shop and go in there with confidence. How are you with, well, I suppose, one, with auditions, and two, the aftermath about, you know, I always say about letting them go as quickly as you can, but we all know that that is, it's easier said than done.
It all depends. Like, I don't think an actor gets mature at any point where there's an audition that will always come up where you'll go, God, I want this. God, this will be amazing. I don't think you ever get to a point where you can kind of go, yeah, okay, I can shrug that one off. Because there'll always be one that comes in. You think, yeah, that could be incredible, be it the experience, be it anything about it, just the joy of playing that particular thing. And I find those tricky to let go of. But I do try and actively, you know, decompartmentalize them and just got to go, right, let's just focus on this. And then I'm going to actively try and just get it out of my head. Just forget about it. Completely forget about it. Because if you don't, though, it'll just eat away slowly over the years, just going, oh, God. If only, again, it goes back to the if onlys again. If only. And our world is a cacophony of if onlys because they're everywhere. You know, they're just scattered around. Plus, you get to see it as well. It's not like you're going for a job interview where you'll probably never, ever meet that person or see that again. You know, you'll literally sit down sometimes and turn it on and go, oh, yeah, I auditioned for this. Oh, God, he is good as well. God, that is really good. That's annoying. You know, and then everyone's going, this is the greatest thing I've ever seen. Oh, God. You know, it's a very different thing. So I think it's incredibly important to, you know, cut it. Just go, right, there we go. I will do all the work. And then I will, you know, push it aside. But what's changed? What's changed recently is the doing the majority of your things in self-tape. Like, that wasn't really a big thing. Now it's every casting is a self-tape. And the difficulty now with, like, I do all my self-tapes with my wife, and she hates them, as in she hates doing them. And the battles that you have of trying to just, you know, because you go into actor mode, and going into actor mode or business mode with someone who is not an actor, you realise that you can be a bit of an arsehole. Like, no, because I've got to focus on this because it's quite tricky. It's a tricky little speech and it's got to hit the rhythm. And if it doesn't hit the rhythm, then it doesn't work. And you're going, God, all right. Oh, you missed this word out. Please don't tell me I've missed a word. Just, did it make sense? Yes, okay. Because I can show you some videos from the Breaking Bad castings where he doesn't really get anything right, but it's the mood. It's the mood he's creating. And I'm just trying to create the mood. So that's quite a change. Where we're always very glad to kind of just draw a line. Go, have you done it? Have you edited it? Have you sent it off? Right, let's just forget about that, and we'll move on to something else.
I mean, that is a real test of marriage, to involve your wife in self-tapes, I think
it's a real testing ground. It really is, especially when you'll say to her, could you just give it a bit more here? Sorry, can I do what? Just there, just. When you say that, could you just mean it a bit?
Oh, you're directing me now.
Yeah.
Great.
That's, yeah. And that's like, oh, okay, okay. This is supposed to be a lighthearted romantic comedy, and at the moment we are not talking, I see. So that's, this is obviously going to be shown, and you'll see and feel it as the tension on screen.
But I do think, with auditions, I do think it's really important as well to have a little word with yourself and be kind to yourself and, you know, in the aftermath go, right, I'm going to give myself a couple of hours to mull it over and go, oh, if only I did that. Oh, why did I say that? Mm. Oh, I think I shook their hand. I mean, no one's shaking hands anymore. No one's in audition rooms. It's not going to happen. But just to mull it over and give yourself that time and space, and then hopefully it'll just, the memories will fly away on their own.
Yeah, totally, yeah. No, I agree. I think, yes, you've got to allow yourself little moments. It's horrible, though, when it suddenly comes back in the middle of the night. Oh, my God, it meant that. Oh, my God, they meant that. Oh, I really didn't. Oh, shit. Oh, well. I'll be hearing from them. That's fine.
But just going back, because, you know, as we've sort of established, the last few years are, I mean, from the outset, I would say they're going pretty well career-wise, and not that we talk about jobs on this podcast, but I do think in this respect it is important. Mm. But jumping back years prior to that, was it as smooth, or were there times when you thought, I don't think this is happening, or things aren't happening at a pace that is healthy, or what I need in my life right now is the security of work?
Yeah. Oh, very definitely. There was a period, you know, I'd ended drama school, and I'd pretty much gone straight from drama school straight into a TV series. And then when that finished, I did three seasons of this kids show, which oddly had James Corden in it as well. That was his first TV thing as well. Mm. And then I went straight on to Hollyoaks after that, again, sort of, you know, young actor, all that kind of stuff. And then came out of that. I'll decide to leave because I want to do other things and try other stuff and that kind of thing. And I think it was just a very funny, this is what I tell myself, it was a very funny time that when you leave a soap and then we're trying to establish yourself in doing, well, you know, I want to do something either serious or comedy or something else. And so then it was quite hard. There was a few dribs and drabs, and then during that, in my sort of mid-20s, it really dried up. Like, there was very, very little.
Do you think that was because they'd put you in that box and they weren't letting you out?
I think so. It's very hard. It could very easily have just been me, but it did feel that I was kind of in a box, and I kind of looked a certain way, as in sort of, you know, young spiky hair like Deck, that kind of thing. And I think it was very difficult to break out of that mold. I just found it very, very difficult. Those kind of mid years, those mid-20, for a good couple of years, were just like no progress, like nothing. Like, it was stagnating. It felt like you were going backwards more than anything else. And so that was very tricky. And it was during that, you know, necessity is the mother of invention. So I can remember, you know, working, as I suppose we've all done to a certain extent, I was working in a bowling alley at one point, and then I was doing, you know, telesales, telemarketing, all the usual stuff that you would do. Just kind of thinking, I just don't understand how to break this rut. I don't know what the thing is that I need to do to just push me out of it, even just a little bit, even just to kind of just shift and things like that. And it was then that I started, through a mate of mine, who was doing stand-up, who said, well, why don't you come and try and do a little... We just do improv comedy classes. Why don't you come along to one of those? Went, okay, fine. He said, because you're quite funny. I said, yes, but, you know, being funny, it's like that thing of being funny in a pub to your mates is one thing. Mm. But actually telling a joke from a cold start where people don't know who you are, all of those, is incredibly difficult and terrifying.
Yeah.
And so it's quite fear-inducing. But I said, okay, I'll try it, or come along. And I think that was kind of just the seed, that beginning of that germination of, oh, okay, I can do things to shift my situation. I can actively kind of take a role in my own future, rather than trying to wait for things to happen and then kind of, you know, railing against, oh, well, I don't understand why they're not doing this, you know, blah, blah, blah. You're kind of going, okay, I'll almost learn a new skill, or I'll try and mold something out of nothing and see what happens. Because also, I realised over the years that sometimes you can set off to do something with a goal in mind. Like, okay, I'm going to go into a comedy class and I'll start to do stand-up. And it might not even be... The reason you're doing it might not be self-evident. It could just be the people you meet. You could meet that one person doing all of that. You might jettison the comedy at all, but you'll meet that one person and you'll team up and you'll do something. Or you'll inspire each other to do something that will lead on to something else. And that was the reason you did it. It's not necessarily, I'm going to go to a comedy class to be funny. It might be something else. And I found that's been invaluable over the years. It's just being very open to things and just trying it, almost going back to go forwards, just take the bull by the horns and just do it. Just try it. What's to be, you're no better off wherever you are. Just give it a go. The worst that can happen is your crap. But you will have learned that, and then you'll know not to do it again. So you can then learn and grow and go on and do something else. But you'll have met people, like-minded people, you know, artists, creatives, that will, you know, help and support you. And they did. You know, it's those relationships kind of stay with you. You might not think it at the beginning, but they kind of travel with you. So that's been very interesting. But, yeah, they were very tough, strange days to get out of that. Do you think
was there ever a time when it crossed your mind to jack it all in? And
yes, there was. There was, just because you kind of then looking at your friends who do other jobs, who just had normal, you know, jobs in offices and things like that, and they were starting to earn money, and you know, you were always the poor actor, always the sort of poor relation that couldn't really afford this, couldn't afford that, could just make rent every month. So there did come a point where we kind of go, yes, but I quite like the trappings of what they have. I quite like that, and that's not a bad thing to want that. But then there was another aspect of going, but I don't want to be in a situation in 20 years' time of going, God, if I'd only given it another 6 months.
Hey, we've gone back to if only.
If only again.
Yeah,
if only I'd have done that. But, you know, the wonderful thing in hopefully in this story is I circumvented that and just said, I'm going to keep doing it. I'm just going to keep going. I'm just going to keep doing it. I will give it another 6 months. And I can't remember who it was. I read an autobiography where they say, well, you know, what you do is you give it another 6 months. And if at the end of the 6 months it's not there, well, then you give it another 6 months. You just keep going. If you've got the drive and determination and the staying power and hopefully the talent that will latch at some point, then it will happen. You know, it's not for the faint hearted. This is a job not for the faint hearted. You know, you've got to have confidence and resolve.
Absolutely.
To keep going. Because a lot of people will say, don't do it. Because it's just the way of the nature of the beast. And you've just got to kind of just plot your path and go with it.
And also, sometimes those people saying, don't do it, or who are guiding you when you're younger and saying, maybe you should think about just digging this trench for, you know, 10 years. I've no doubt. It's often those people who are actually projecting their fear onto you because they're scared. I still know people now go, how could you possibly do what you do and not... You're doing a job from, like, September to December. Yes. So how often in that job, that period, will you be actually filming? Well, I don't know yet. When do you know? Well, I don't know until probably about 5 weeks before, because they have to do a filming schedule, and that's kind of how it works. It just fills them with
dread. Oh, yeah, and then that dread and fear. But then that could change.
Yes.
That could change, like, literally day to day, depending on what's going on or... I mean, that could... So you don't know what's going... Oh, yeah. So you could learn something and then they won't use that. They'll go, oh, actually, we're going to bring scenes forward because we need to do this instead. So it blows people's minds. Go, God, I did it. But I thrive on that. I enjoy that.
And that's an ever-changing
field.
Well, especially after such a lengthy period of time and, the precarious nature of this job. Oh, yeah, I thought you were in that film... Oh, yeah. I filmed it. But I saw it. Oh, yeah, I got cut. I'm not. Oh, how did that feel? Yeah, a bit gutting at the time. But that's, you know, that's just the way it is. That's the way it is.
Yeah.
No, I've got to go. I've got to be in the office for 9 o'clock now. So
Bye. Absolutely. These aren't going to file themselves, Marjorie. I understand. I understand. Good day to you.
Tim, this has been such a lovely conversation. I'm really pleased that you came on and we got time to do this.
No, as am I. As am I. No, it's been a real treat.
Well, thank you so much. And I'm going to let you go. And I've got a drizzly Saturday to contend with.
Gorgeous. Lovely drizzly Saturday. Wonderful.
You take care, my friend.
Take care, mate.
And another episode is done. What did I tell you? Tim is great. He's got a lovely, fruity, rich voice, which I adore. And we finished at a perfect time then, because just seconds after we paused recording, his daughter came in to tell him that there was a man at the door for a mobile COVID test because he was off to the Ukraine to film. So, yeah, it's all about timing. I really hope you enjoyed that episode. It was fab. It was a delight to have Tim on. Now, you know where to find us. If you want to drop us an email, it's twoshotpod@gmail.com. We're on all the socials at twoshotpod. Drop us a message. Let me know what you think. I have got some incredible guests lined up to record. I have a reverend, I have a rock star, I have a journalist, I have an author, I have a television presenter, and of course, I'll have actors. And I'm really trying to get... Oh, I've got a very, very exciting chef as well. See, we're getting out there. And I can't wait to meet as many of these people in person as I can. Speaking of in person, let's be honest, we would love a live show, wouldn't we? All get together in the same room, have a fantastic conversation, throw questions out to the audience. We'd like that, wouldn't we? I don't think it's going to happen this year. I seriously don't. I just don't think we're ready for it. I mean, we want it. Are we ready? I know, let's keep our powder dry with that. Look, you take care, and I'm hopefully not getting too wet on my holiday in Cornwall, but we'll see, and we'll see you next week. So until then, I've been Craig Parkinson, he's been producer Griff, and this has been the Two Shot Podcast. I feel like I've got hay fever. I'll see you next week. The Two Shot Podcast is presented by me, Craig Parkinson, recorded and produced by Thomas Griffin for Splicing Block. Our music, our brilliant music, is courtesy of Then Thickens. Cheers.